Hi, this is Katie.
It's you.
And welcome to Just Ask the Question. Today, we're going to be covering abdominal compartment syndrome, anion gap, base deficit, and talking a little bit about some core nursing values.
Yeah, and this is episode 3
for yes.
those of us, or those of you who have been
following along.
Kind of following along, exactly. Yeah, great. Okay, so Katie, do you want to start?
Yeah, so let's start with, we'll start with abdominal compartment syndrome. What is it? What do we do for it? Why is it important in our patient population?
Yeah, great question. So I think in the, you know, if you listen to this podcast later, this will be lost on you. But I think for us recently, there have been a couple of patients where this has been relevant.
Yeah. So we've had what? We've had a couple of open bellies, which, yeah, where it's just been like, it's been kind of the outcome of it, or people have been saying they can't have that because they're open belly, and some of the monitoring stuff too has been really relevant on our floor.
Right. So a couple of things. So when we think about abdominal compartment syndrome, essentially it describes any situation where the pressure within the abdomen is higher than normal.
Okay.
Now, there's no direct way to easily measure the pressure in the abdomen.
Right.
But usually when it's present, it's quite obvious on exam. Not always, but usually quite obvious.
Right.
And so when you think back to the patients that we've had recently, what did they look like?
Their belly's big, distended. It keeps getting bigger. Looks quite painful. The couple of patients we've had with it have not been conscious.
And so when you pressed on the abdomen,
it does not move.
Very taut.
Yes.
A lot of tension.
Yeah.
So those are the clinical findings or exam findings that would make me suspicious for somebody with abdominal compartment syndrome. Not just okay. distension, but also the tautness of it.
Right.
And there are some more objective ways to estimate the intra-abdominal pressure.
Right.
And probably the one that we rely on the most is measuring the bladder pressure.
Right.
And so, you know, we put a Foley in for these patients, and mm-hmm. then in theory, they should be paralyzed, but we often get an initial reading before they're paralyzed.
Okay.
And you just measure the pressure inside the bladder.
Yeah. Okay. Paralyzed and closed?
Paralyzed in anything.
Okay. Right?
So any patient, you put a Foley in, and then you just measure their bladder pressure.
Okay.
And that should give you an idea of their intra-abdominal pressure.
Okay. And then, so I might be wrong, but you want the pressure below 20?
So in terms of what's normal and what's abnormal,
right?
The cutoff is 20.
Okay.
Really, 20 is chosen because you want a little leeway.
Okay.
Right. 20. Some people really say 25, but anything under that, well under that, is basically normal, right?
Okay.
And anything above that is concerning.
Right.
If somebody has bladder pressure above 20, and especially above 25. You know, my next step will be to ask you to paralyze the patient, you know, assuming they're
sure.
intubated, so that we can confirm that reading.
Okay.
Not being paralyzed will sometimes elevate that reading. And, you know, all the data and evidence is, you know, normalized to somebody who's paralyzed, essentially.
Okay.
The reason that the number 25 or 20 is relevant is really kind of the same reason why we choose a MAP of 60 for most patients. It's not totally arbitrary.
Okay.
It has to do with the amount of pressure that the capillaries typically need to see to perfuse tissue. So a normal capillary driving pressure in the tissue is about 30 millimeters of mercury. And so the idea here is that if your abdominal compartment pressures are higher than that, then you're starving the tissues of any ability to see any.
Okay, and that's because essentially, right, you don't have your pressure is creeping up and kind of shutting those capillaries down.
Exactly.
It's kind of like, I don't know, crushing a balloon or something.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's closing out the capillaries
right.
mechanically just from pressure.
Okay.
And so what are the consequences of somebody who has abdominal compartment syndrome? What is the consequence of, you know, what's the problem?
So you worry about dead tissue at that point.
Yeah.
Right.
And so you worry about dead tissue, not just in the abdominal, you know, outer layers,
right.
but also the internal organs.
Right.
Right. And then the last thing is, from our standpoint, we often worry about IVC compression.
Okay.
And often people with abdominal compartment syndrome will give the presentation that they're very volume seeking, very dry.
Right.
because a lot of times there's a sequestration of their venous return.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
So they'll present as dry essentially because the fluid is just going to that compartment, or?
Yeah, often the fluid will be shifting to other compartments, but the biggest thing is that there's, you know, there's some compression of venous return from the IVC.
Okay.
And so like every time you give the patient fluid, they respond robustly.
Right.
But then they start circulating that fluid.
Okay.
And when that blood circulates, about half of it is going to the upper body and about half is going to the lower body. The problem is that if the half that goes to the lower body has a hard time making it out of the IVC, it will just end up
stuck. So you're just trapping it in that area, and then the patient can't circulate the fluid, can't get it pumped to where it needs to go, and then you're tanking your pressures or whatever again.
And so they look dry again, because every time you circulate, you know, every circulation of blood, so to speak, you might be losing a quarter of your circulating volume.
So if you're dumping fluid into these patients, so they're presenting as dry, you're dumping fluid into them, and then do you eventually then just get a buildup of fluid, and that then also then makes the problem worse?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
And so how do we get around, or how do we resolve this? Well, typically speaking, the only way to resolve abdominal compartment syndrome in a you know, rapid enough fashion that you can accept it is an XLAP. And that will typically relieve enough pressure to get you out of abdominal compartment syndrome territory from a pressure standpoint.
Okay.
Now, if you have to be careful, because we've had some patients in recent memory where even though they had an XLAP and their abdomen was open, they were so aggressively packed and there was so much excess fluid that was soaked into these pads that their abdominal pressures were still very high.
Right, correct.
I would make the argument that even though in theory you shouldn't be able to develop compartment syndrome, abdominal compartment syndrome in somebody with an open abdomen, from a practical standpoint, if you have enough lap pads, you have enough excess fluid in the abdomen, you can still get there. And so I think the right answer in that situation is to evacuate everything out of the abdomen.
Okay.
Make sure your XLAP incision is as wide, or not wide, as long as it can be, just to give the abdomen room to breathe.
Yeah.
And then you probably need to put a vac of some sort on it to evacuate the fluid.
Okay.
That's going to eventually build up in the,
abdomen. So again, for patients and for people who are listening who took care of this patient or these patients that we're kind of talking about, this patient, this patient had a wound vac or some sort of already on. And then the theory was it was removed, or at least told to me that it was removed because there was concern for compartment syndrome. And then they packed the abdomen. It sounds like that's not the way you would traditionally think about it.
My understanding, and I mean, I think I know the case you're talking about, and I don't know the specifics because I didn't take care of the patient.
Right.
My guess is that they thought that the wound vac probably was had clotted, and was not performing its function.
Okay.
So, which is why they abandoned it and decided to pack the patient, which is totally fine.
Right.
But the problem is then what you have to do at some point is you have to remove or change that packing as it gets saturated.
Right.
It's almost like, you know, in some ways, I think for that particular case, the patient could only almost be treated as a heavily gravid pregnant patient.
Okay.
Just because of how much weight was on the abdomen.
Right.
And in those patients, I'm sure you haven't worked much with OB patients, but the classic teaching is once they're in the, you know, once they're probably in the third trimester and they have a substantial amount of weight in the uterus, is that you never want to lay them totally flat.
Okay.
And one of the reasons you don't want to do that is because the uterus can literally, obstruct IVC venous return.
Okay.
Just by mechanical weight. So all those patients during C-sections, during any procedure or whatever, will always be positioned in a left lateral decubitus position.
Okay, yeah.
And that's the reason, is because you want to get that weight off of the IVC.
Okay.
Just roll them over so that all the weight kind of shifts to the left. And I wonder if for that person, if we had done that, whether they would have looked a little bit better in retrospect. But I think the big picture is that, you know, the takeaway message I would say is that any time the abdomen is really taut, I would not hesitate to check a bladder pressure.
Okay.
If it's low, then you've got nothing to worry about. Just somebody with a taut abdomen. Yeah. Maybe they walk around like that. I'm not here to judge. I've met a few people like that, right?
Yeah.
But if there's a clinical concern, they're not looking so hot, that's definitely something that should be on your differential.
All right. So from a nursing standpoint, you see this patient, taut abdomen. They're very fluid responsive, potentially look at talking to your team about maybe not reducing the amount of fluid, but going a different route, look at potentially repositioning the patient and getting a bladder pressure to see where you're at.
Yeah. And I think that of all the acute interventions that you can make at the bedside, the right. one that will make the most difference for the patient is just getting a bladder pressure. Because okay. I think that the hardest thing about this is making the diagnosis mm-hmm. because it's not something that we deal with on a routine basis.
Right.
And so I think that if you check the bladder pressure, right, I don't think you need anybody, you don't need to talk to anybody on the team to do that.
Right.
It's well within your
yeah.
Skill set to just do it. And then if it's really low, then you're reassured to some degree. You can still tell the team, hey, I checked this. This is what it was.
Yeah.
But if it's high, then it pretty much, with only a few exceptions, pretty much confirms what's going on. So.
Okay.
Okay.
Great.
Good.
Perfect.
Yes. All right.
Moving on to the next one.
Okay.
Okay. So I feel like we should kind of do these together. What do you think? So we've got explain base deficit and explain anion gap.
Okay.
Or do you want to do, how do you want to do this?
However you want me to do it. But to me, I agree. I think it makes sense. It's just a general question about blood gases. Right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So a couple of things. I guess maybe we'll tackle the anion gap first because I think it's very concrete.
Right.
So the anion gap is a concept that comes from the fact that we measure a lot of the electrolytes in your body,
mm-hmm.
but not all of the electrolytes.
Okay.
Right. So we measure the ones that are most common, right?
Right.
Sodium, potassium.
Calcium.
Yeah, calcium, bicarb.
Yeah.
You know, all the big ones.
Yeah. Right?
And that leaves a few charged particles, many charged particles unmeasured for.
Sure. Right?
So we don't routinely measure the albumin, for example. But albumin right. is actually a negative charged particle. Right?
That's a fun fact.
Yeah. And so the anion gap essentially comes from the difference between the calculated or measured value of the really common particles in terms of the cations, right?
Okay.
The positively
sure.
charged molecules,
right.
and the anions, the negatively charged
okay.
molecules. So the formula for the anion gap is the sodium,
mm-hmm.
often plus the potassium, although some people leave it out because it's just a relatively small number,
okay.
minus the bicarb, or minus chloride, right?
Okay.
And so you're just balancing the positive and the negative charges.
Okay.
And, you know, humans are not magnets, right? Obviously.
Right.
And so one of the things that is very important for your body to function normally is to maintain the homeostasis of net neutral charge so that you don't get sucked into your fridge or whatever, right? And so recognize that if you have a patient right now while you're listening to this or next time you see a patient, open up their chart.
Yeah.
Look at their BNP.
Okay.
Right. So if you look at their BNP or blood gas, take their sodium and then you subtract their bicarb, you subtract their potassium,
I'm sorry. So is it, it's the sodium and the potassium together minus the bicarb?
Minus the bicarb, minus the chloride as well.
Okay.
Right. So sodium plus potassium minus bicarb minus chloride.
Okay.
Right. And so you take all the positives and all the negatives. And you basically add up all the positives and then subtract away all the negatives.
Right.
And you'll find in a normal patient, the anion gap is like, let's say like 6 to 12 or something like that.
Okay. Yeah.
So that 6 to 12 essentially represents, how would I phrase this? That 6 to 12 represents all the unmeasured anions that then exist in your body.
Okay.
That we're not really accounting for.
Okay.
And so, like I said, you know, a normal amount of albumin hangs around your body. And so
right.
your normal anion gap is like 6 to 12.
Okay.
If you had no albumin, it would be zero, right? Obviously. But that doesn't happen.
Right.
And then there are also minor molecules like PO4, which is negative, right? Phosphorus.
Okay. Right.
That we don't really measure
okay.
Routinely. And so they don't get accounted for, but they can all kind of plug into your anion gap.
Okay.
So what happens when the anion gap elevates, right?
Right.
What it tells you is that there is now a new molecule somewhere in your body.
Okay.
Right, that is net negative charged.
Right.
But you're not measuring directly.
Okay. Okay.
Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah.
So for example, one very common cause of an elevated anion gap in our unit is lactic acidemia.
Okay. Right? Yeah.
So lactic acid will dissociate into a positively charged hydrogen ion, and then the negative weak base of like lactic acid with a negative charge.
Yeah. Right?
And so that negative charge does not get measured, but obviously the overall system balance has to remain right. neutral. So what usually happens is it pushes out the chloride. You can think of it that way. Pushes
okay,
the
yeah.
chloride out of your body. And when the chloride is, and also the bicarb out of your body, right?
Right.
Because what happens is then the hydrogen ion will then interact with the bicarb and form water.
Okay.
So it pushes both the chloride ion and also the bicarb levels down.
Right.
And then you develop an anion gap mathematically.
Okay. So then you're going to see a bigger gap there.
So you see a bigger gap.
Right. Okay.
And so the anion gap is a purely artificial construct, right?
Right.
Based on the lab values. But it is a useful heuristic for us to estimate when the electrolytes are wonky.
Okay.
Does right. that kind of make sense?
Yeah. It's like, hey, we're using this just kind of be like, hey, something's not right here. Yeah. We can't directly measure all of these things, yeah. but these are the things we should look at.
Right. What we know from an elevated ion gap is that for whatever reason,
yeah.
you don't have as much negatively charged, you know, typical molecules right. in your body as you right. should.
So it's kind of a cue to look at your right. what else, whatever have you on your blood gas, on your labs, just be like, okay, this anion gap's different. Right. It's wacky. It's weird. Whatever. Let me look at. What could be causing it in that case? Lactic acidemia or whatever else.
Totally. Okay. And the other thing to recognize is that there are many causes of an elevated anion gap.
Okay.
Okay. It's not simply lactic acidosis. Right. In fact, there's a whole mnemonic. If you are interested, you can Google it.
Okay.
Mud piles is how I learned it. So the point is that most of the causes of an elevated anion gap are not benign.
Right.
They're actually... Most of them are quite concerning,
right?
Outside of a few exceptions. So whenever we see an elevated gap, we need to do a little bit of extra investigation.
Okay. Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
The last thing is the base deficit. So the base deficit is basically calculated off of what your bicarb is measured.
Okay.
And then what it ought to be based on your... I guess your pH otherwise.
Okay.
And so it's a quick way of the ABG to estimate how much bicarb you are quote unquote missing in your body.
Okay.
It's not really the case for most patients that they're missing bicarb.
Mm-hmm.
What really is happening is for most patients, they have some degree of metabolic acidosis.
Okay.
And because of that acidosis, again, you have a hydrogen ion that then interacts with the bicarb and then it forms water. And when that happens, it drops your bicarb concentration.
Right.
And that gives you a base deficit.
Right.
So again, in our unit, the most common cause of a base deficit is somebody with metabolic acidosis.
Okay.
Usually, not always, but often lactic acidosis.
Right.
When they come out of the OR.
Yeah.
Right. And so that is the base deficit.
Okay.
There is a, I don't want to say classic, but there's a common heuristic or teaching in medicine that you treat a base deficit with fluids.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. I was actually having this conversation this morning with one of our orientees because she was like, well, we were looking at this patient's ABG, their lactic acid peaked at like 12, their base deficit was like -7, something like that. And she was like, well, wouldn't we treat this with fluid or how would they go about treating this? And we were kind of going back and forth on it for a little while. So, yeah.
So I think that is a very simplified heuristic and one that is not appropriate for our patient population.
Okay.
If you're dealing with young trauma patients,
right.
9 times out of 10, they're acidemic because they're hypovolemic.
Okay.
They got shot or they were in a car accident and they're bleeding to death.
Right.
They need fluid resuscitation.
Right.
And once you provide them with fluid resuscitation, their cardiac output will get better. Their acidosis will get better.
Okay.
And you have treated the base deficit with fluids.
Right.
Our patients are obviously more complicated than that from a circulatory standpoint, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes our patients get a better cardiac output from a fluid bolus. Sometimes it gets worse.
Right.
Sometimes
right.
their EF sucks. And if you give them more fluid, you're only going to hurt yourself in the long run.
Sure.
So I think that we, you know, for us in our patient population, we have to be very careful about the idea of using fluids to treat the base deficit. The other thing I'll say lastly is that the base deficit is a purely calculated fictitious number even more fictitious than the anion gap. It doesn't represent anything physiologically. Right. All it tells you is that your bicarb is low,
right?
Relative to the pH, and it implies that you most likely have a metabolic acidosis. And okay. Beyond that, I would not really think about it too much more.
Okay.
Okay.
Great.
Wonderful.
Perfect.
Okay, so I think for the last bit of this podcast, it's running a little long already. I think. I'm a little long-winded today.
That's all right. I feel like it's a good conversation.
Okay, good. So I think I just want to switch up the format a little bit.
Okay.
And I want to ask you, because you've been at the bedside for a few years now.
Yeah.
I want to ask you about this topic.
Okay.
I want your insight. You know, we all work in a kind of unique job setting, right?
Right,
You know, it's one thing to work in an office job or, you know, whatever, right? But I think that we all have chosen to do something that is probably a little bit more taxing than most jobs, emotionally and physically. But the payoff can be quite rewarding.
Right.
When we see our patients get better, it's very rewarding, I think.
I agree.
So the question I think I have is, you know, as people who work in healthcare, taking care of very vulnerable patients, what are the values? What are the core values that you think we should aspire to? And I've become interested in this recently, mostly because I think I'm getting older and more philosophical, but also just in general, you know, for people who are just getting into the field. And for them, like, they're just trying to survive the job.
Right.
I think it's important for them to start thinking about, what am I aspirating to?
Right.
Right. I think that's just important.
I don't know. It's kind of a hard question because I think, right, we have, like, Yale New Haven itself has all of its core values, its CHAMP behaviors, its whatever else. And you look at it, especially when you're a new grad, and what most of our new grads are 26, like, we're young, and especially the team on the unit I work on, we're super young. We're new, we're just out of school, et cetera, et cetera. And you look at that stuff and you're like, what the fuck? Like, what do I do with this? And so I think, and then I think the other flip side to that too, is we work in an ICU. And again, we have a lot of new grads in the ICU. And so we're just trying to figure out the numbers. We're just trying to figure out the word's escaping me, just like the thing itself, the job itself, the science part of the job, the technicalities of the job. Yeah,
like the technical side, the workflow side. How do I be competent in my job?
Right, exactly. Because these are sick patients. They're sick patients. There's a lot expected in our ICUs, especially of us, and a lot of devices and a lot of that. But I think one thing I've heard over and over again from our APPs or older nurses is that sometimes, like, there's this idea, and especially when you're in school too, there's this idea they want you to start in med surg right out of nursing school. And I think that's a mixed bag, and take that how you will. But I actually, and I started in the ICU, so I don't really have a lot of ground on this. But I will say, I think there is an element of when you start directly in the ICU, you lose that humanistic end of it a little bit because you are trying to deal with the technical aspects of the job. You are trying to figure out the numbers. You are trying to learn about base deficit and whatever else.
And it, those are very important to learn about.
Right. It's super important, but we work with humans and it's a very human job, right? It's nursing. We clean up people. We see people when they're the most vulnerable. And I think we need to sometimes remember that a little bit. Like, brushing a patient's hair might make more of a difference than you just swooping in, swooping out, and grabbing a number.
Yeah.
And I think we lose some of that in our ICUs when you start there directly. But I think, right, core values, obviously, it's always going to be respect for the patient, respect for yourself. We have to remember that these people also aren't always going to respect us and what we do and how we do our job. And I think that's a very, very hard part of the job for a lot of us.
It makes it challenging when the patients don't show you the same level of respect that you feel you're showing them.
Right. And it's like, right, and that being said, you can't ever show them any less respect because that's, again, they're the vulnerable ones here, not us. And so I think that's, like, the biggest thing. We have to remember all of that. We have to remember to work together. We have to remember to be kind to people. And you just got to remember that, like, we're taking care of very sick people.
Yeah.
And their families.
Yeah.
And I think, I don't know where I'm going with this. It's a little rambly, but yeah, okay. That's kind of, again, I haven't been in it this long. I've been in it for a couple of years, yeah. But I think the humanistic end of the job is what makes it nursing.
I agree.
So, yeah.
And I think if I can, obviously I'm not a nurse, but I think if I can add one thing that I think has been valuable to me is to not lose sight of the fact that at the end of the day, you know, there is a technical component, like you said. There is a bare bones, this is the care that I am obligated to give you component.
Right.
But I think to go above and beyond that, we have to recognize that also there's a service component.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, we're here not just to always, you know, give antibiotics or give meds on time, but also on some level, we're here to serve our patients, like you said, as people.
Right.
So it's interesting. I only want to bring this up to you, and we're kind of running long here, so that's okay. But I just wanted to bring up this topic because I think we've got so many people who I think are, as you say, in the phase of their career where they are still learning their trade.
Right.
And I think it's very appropriate, totally appropriate, for them to be hyper-focused on their skill set.
Yeah, I agree.
I think that, you know, what I would say as somebody, like I said, getting older must be it. What I would say to these people or to everybody is don't lose sight of the reason, right?
Yeah.
That you're doing this, right?
Yeah.
And that's it.
That's it. That being said, we always want your questions. And if you have more to add on this topic too, if someone has, who's been a nurse longer than I have or wants to chime in, we're more than happy to hear it.
Great. So is that it? Is that the,
I think that's it.
Episode for this week or for this month, I guess.
We'll see. I think that's good.
Okay. All right. So we will see everybody or,
talk to everyone.
Talk to everybody. you know, next time.
Yeah. Okay. See you next time.
Thanks.
Okay. Bye.